Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2016. Lecture 11, delivered on February 16, 2016. The title of this lecture is Interest Rates in Finance.
Today, interest rates in finance. Now, the current chapter in the textbook, Chapter 5, covers some of the territory that I covered in the first, or rather in the second week, in special topics. I'm going to go back through that, add to it today, show you a few new skills to add to your skill set in using financial calculators, and bring up a few new terms for you. But to start the ball rolling, just as a to see how much you remember from the second week of the course, when I say interest rate, what do I mean by an interest rate? What does interest rate mean?
Well, you said that, I believe you said that it was pretty general, like it could mean a lot.
You're right about that. I mean, there is not the interest rate. You're absolutely right about that. Well, let's start with one like just the real rate of return. What is that?
It's the rate minus, or...
Don't do that. Don't give me a formula. Give me a description. Okay?
Well, it's a rate excluding or considering inflation.
No. No. Okay. You're still trying to give me sort of like a formula. One thing about my tests, the in-class tests, I don't ever want to see you give me a formula or describe a formula. I want you to give me a narrative explanation. If I want a formula, I'll go ask an accountant or an actuary. But so, do you remember what an interest rate is? The real interest rate.
The real interest
yeah.
Rate.
That's okay. It was many years ago. Go ahead.
Interest rate is kind of like extra money they want on top of what you already
owe. Actually, that's not too bad. You're actually getting on the right track there. Go ahead.
Foregone alternative.
You have a piece of it in your notes there. It's the opportunity cost of foregone consumption. It's just what you give up if you don't get to use your money now. You want a cheeseburger. If you lend me that money, you can't have your cheeseburger. How can you have your cheeseburger if you don't have any money? So I have to compensate you at a very basic level before anything else, before the inflation premium, the expected inflation premium, before the default premium, the maturity premium, and the illiquidity premium. There's got to be a compensation just for the fact that you're giving up your consumption now. An alternative way of thinking about it from a more technical standpoint in terms of economics would be another way to look at it from a macroeconomic point of view would be to say that it is essentially the raw equilibrium of supply of and demand for money. In other words, there's a place where supply of money meets the demand for money. That is the real interest rate. And remember that it is a rate. It's a rental rate. Anything that's a rate is a rental rate in finance. So essentially, I'm renting money from you. You charge me a rental rate. That rental rate at its very heart is just because you're going to give up some money for it. Now, bear with me here, one second. Let me crank up the... what I'm doing right now is just giving you a little review because I do expect that those early concepts weren't locking in really all that great. And so I go back through them, and as I told you, I layer things a lot of times in this course. I will repeat myself several times before I would ever test you on certain basic concepts. And one of those would be this one. And so while that thing is grinding away trying to wake up. I'm going to write that any interest rate that you're ever going to see is a combination of the risk-free rate and this risk premium that you'll see here as soon as that thing wakes up out of its slumber. Hang on here. Let me pull you over to the document camera. Seriously? There. Did we not pay the light bill or something? There. Let me zoom that in a little bit for you. Okay, so the risk-free rate, that is the one that is the combination of the real rate and the expected inflation premium. Sort of the base of all interest rates. Now, the risk-free rate can be proxied. Old school would be to say, well, that's kind of close to, that would be best approximated by a short-term T-bill's yield. Because a short-term T-bill has no other premiums in it. All it has is the real rate and the expected rate of inflation. Now, interestingly enough, and I'll bring this up again, I might have already mentioned it. Traditionally, back in the day, we would always, whenever we had a formula that had the risk-free rate, we'd just pull out the annualized yield on a three-month T-bill or something like that. Anymore, interestingly enough, and I've run into this, and I guess I see the logic of it. These days, a lot of times, they won't, if you've got a formula where you need the risk-free rate, you need a number. What they'll do is they'll pull out the yield on a 10-year treasury note or treasury bond or some like a 7-year treasury note. There's a logic to it, and I'll explain it to you later. But anyway, if you run into it in practice, and you might very well in some courses that you take, indeed in this one you will, the risk-free rate as a theoretical animal to approximate it, you would use a yield on something that was virtually riskless. And it would have to be relatively short-term, too, so you didn't have the maturity premium in there. But anyway, the R sub D R plus R sub M plus R sub L, that is what we call the risk premium. That's what adds the flavor to any actual interest rate you would see. Every interest rate would have its own combination of these three, a default premium, representing the possibility that some or all of the cash flow will not be returned. The maturity premium, representing the risk associated with volatility of interest rates over the life of the instrument. And the liquidity premium, or the illiquidity premium, as I think the book calls it, the risk associated with not being able to unload a debt security or any kind of security if you really needed to fast. So in other words, there would be like a CD. Have you ever seen these CDs, substantial interest penalty for early withdrawal? Well, in other words, they're making you pay, there's going to be a liquidity premium in there. You're not going to get your money back unless you pay a fee or a fine. And so you'll see CDs having a slightly higher interest rate because they are illiquid. You can't get your money back right away on them, unless you want to get whacked with a penalty. Anyway, putting these three, all these together, you get an interest rate. At its core is this beast right here. And all other interest rates will float on top of this one. Now, sometimes they float on two layers. You, sir, you're going to the internship fair, I can tell. Snazzy, very snazzy. A little gangstery, but you know, there you are. When you were a kid, you took baths, right? You know, there was this one place I saw these giant rubber duckies. I mean, they were huge. Now, most people buy a little rubber ducky for the tub, but you could get one of these. So instead of floating on top of the water, you could get on top of the rubber ducky and float on the water on the rubber ducky. Now you're looking at me and say, what the hell does this have to do? The truth of the matter is that actually some instruments do base right off the treasury bill yield, a short-term treasury bill yield. In other words, they float right on the water, somewhere above it, with the risk premium in there somewhere. However, a lot of interest rates, especially in the past many decades, float on top of another interest rate that floats on the risk-free rate. So in other words, you probably, a loan that you would get or a discount rate that you would use for some present value of something or future value would probably, it could be the T-bill yield. That would be floating right on top of the water. T-bill, 3-month T-bill annualized plus 5%. But you could have another layer that's actually the T-bill yield is still underneath there, but the rate that you are quoted would be based upon the rubber ducky. And there are several of these. One of them is what's called the bank prime rate. Prime rate is essentially an index, an average of the interest rate that banks are charging their best customers, their big money customers. You're Mr. Fat Wallet. You own Giant Mega Industries, Inc. Well, you would probably be charged the prime rate. Your bank would charge you a really good rate. Now, you might also be some industrial genius, and your bank charges you a really good rate. Might not be exactly his. So they would take the average of these rates, and that forms what we call the prime rate. And it's sort of like, and then other banks that don't get involved in actually figuring out what rate, they'll look at the prime rate as their substrate for all rates. You, sir, you are not important. But you go to the bank for a loan. Whatever they quoted you as the interest rate for the loan would probably be a float, prime plus 4, something like that. Okay, you follow the idea? Prime rate's one of these rubber duckies. There's another one out there. Of course, the Fed funds rate is one of them too. Now remember that the Fed funds rate is the rate that banks charge each other in the interbank lending market. The Fed funds rate is not set by the Federal Reserve, but the Federal Reserve busts its butt all the time to influence it. So when the Fed executes open market operations to add money to the money supply, what I would be doing is I want to add money to this money supply, and you're a bank. What I would do is I would buy treasury bills from you in your portfolio. That would force the interest rates downward because essentially I would bid up the price of the bonds and bills until you said yes. Price goes up, yield goes down. That would affect the treasury bill yield. But also when I bought them, I would pay you in money. You would put that in this giant pool of money called the federal funds pool. And so there would be a greater supply, so Fed funds rate would go down. So it's an indirect effect that the Federal Reserve has on it. It still has kind of a mind of its own. And that's kind of one of the things that we look at over a long period of time. The Fed sets a target for the Fed funds rate. And in the short run, the Fed funds rate will try to track what the Fed says we want it to be. Interestingly enough, though, over time, as the Fed pushes its influence too hard, the Fed funds rate begins to separate from what the Fed wants it to do. That's when the Fed begins to say, oh, we've got to change our strategy and our policy because we're no longer being listened to. Our influence is disappearing here in this market. But anyway, the Fed funds rate can be one of those. You got try to get a loan. Well, it'll be Fed funds rate plus 6%. Actually, what I would do, and here's a term, just you'll hear me start to use this now. I'll use the term basis points. 100 basis points is a percent. So I'd say, okay, I'm going to lend you money. Fed funds rate plus 550 basis points. Okay, that's 5.5% more. One other one out there that's worth you knowing, and you'll hear it in your professional lives and in other courses, is LIBOR, London Interbank Offering Rate. LIBOR has a long and checkered history. It was not too many years ago that it turned out that LIBOR, which was supposed to be a free market rate, supply and demand, all that, was actually being fixed by a small group of powerful traders. It was being also, the conspiracy involved the highly reputable index company that publishes the prime rate, or I'm sorry, LIBOR. It publishes it every day, and this price fixing was among these very powerful traders, currency traders, and the highly reputable publisher of the rates. Now, that is not the only time that a highly reputable publisher of financial information, timely, daily, hourly, minutely, what have you, has been involved in a price-fixing scandal. It was not more than a few years ago that McGraw-Hill, a subsidiary of McGraw-Hill called Platts, almost got itself indicted. Its offices in Europe were raided for price fixing on gasoline in the futures market. It was in the spot market, something like that. There's still some suspicion that the only reason the insiders were not hauled off and thrown in prison was because the company was so large and Platts was so important to publishing financial information on commodities that it would have caused too much damage if they had thrown the scoundrels in jail. But price fixing in LIBOR, price fixing in commodities, spot price, spot quotes, and all that is something that has been going on. We know it has. The question is, to the best of my knowledge, I've never seen any question about prime rate being subject to price fixing, insider price fixing. Now, I can't say that it might not be blown open as some scandal, but honestly, it seems to be above that kind of price fixing. The only problem, though, is that because we have so few powerful, influential banks, essentially we have an oligopoly. It doesn't have to be price fixing for the price not to be a free market price. So even though prime rate would not be the subject of a collusion set every day by a bunch of insiders, effectively that's what happens when you have an oligopoly. There is no free market supply and demand constantly pushing against each other. It doesn't work that way anymore. Okay, taking all that aside, we have interest rates. What do they mean in practice? Well, the one thing that I had brought up before was looking at interest rates is worth your time. I want you to notice something kind of interesting, curious here. I'm showing you some charts here. Notice how the Treasury is the substrate. You see that? That's the water. And the others are smaller or larger rubber duckies that you can float on top of the water. You see that in there? How that one that's the lowest in that upper chart, there's your one that would be the substrate of all of them. And then above that one, LIBOR. LIBOR, interestingly enough, do you see just the hint of where the price fixing, they got too greedy? Do you see in that upper chart where the price fixers on LIBOR got too greedy? Tell me if you see it. And that kind of was the clue that they were doing something naughty. Do you see it? Where LIBOR is the middle one. Do you see where they sort of turned their hand that they were gaming it, playing it? Do you see it?
It's the blue one.
Yes. It spiked. but none of the others were spiking. Not there. That was the clue. You see, it's so obvious. I mean, if you think about it, you can see it. Once I mentioned it to you, do you see how the other ones didn't spike there? But that son of a bitch just went boom, like that. Ah, there you are. So I had a cat many years ago. I loved the cat dearly. And he had a problem, though. He would try to sneak up on birds, and when he got close enough to get excited, he would start crackling at them. Of course, the bird would fly away, and then he, what the hell, man? Gave itself away there. But anyway, notice something interesting about the prime rate and why it is probably kind of a desirable for as a substrate. Why the bank prime rate is actually somewhat desirable as the base. Do you see why that is? Looking at that top one, the blue one, do you see why the prime rate would probably be a desirable one to base interest rates off from? You don't see it?
It's pretty steady.
Yes, it's steady. It's smooth. You don't have to recalculate every day. Oh, well, today I'll charge you the LIBOR +3, which will be this. And then tomorrow it's somewhere else, so you have to recalculate for someone who gets a loan that day. It has a stability to it. It has a smoothness to it. And so that makes it more of a kind of a desirable one. Yeah, that's good. That's the whole idea. Let me ask you this. Do you like excitement?
Sometimes.
Okay. Let's say, you know, we all like to see movies with excitement. But what if you are the one who's standing in a field and you see a UFO come over and first it aims for this cow and the cow starts going, and then it notices you there and it starts sucking you up. Okay? That's too much excitement because you know what they do in those alien spaceships? Yeah, it's not pretty. I write on people's tests. When they give me a stupid answer, I'll say, you are the reason why aliens experiment on us during abductions. People are very offended by that. It is true. You ever known someone who was a freaking maniac? I did. He had a Lamborghini. He wanted to show me that he could outrun state highway patrolmen in Florida. He did. I will never be the same man again. I found Jesus that day. Especially when he decided to take an off-ramp at 120 miles an hour. Did you know a Lamborghini can do that? I left you know, my dinner back there on the highway. Both ends of it. Anyway. You don't want excitement. You want stability. I'm trying to convince you of that with a few metaphors there or similes or whatever you might want to call them. Okay. Notice, by the way, that these rates are different for different lengths. You probably would set for, like if you're doing short-term lending, you would probably, and you were using LIBOR, you'd probably use a six-month LIBOR as your basis. Six-month LIBOR +400. If you were doing longer-term lending, you would probably set one-year LIBOR +370 basis points, something like that. And then, I hope they have it here right now. I haven't been here in more than a few weeks, I must admit. Oh, that one's. I got the 1 year cough. I don't know if I want to do that. Holy, what the hell? Oh, those are the coughs. So there are so many, literally so many, that you have to get a sense of them one by one. I can show you a lot of different ones. They're showing you a couple of them, cough one and cough two, cough three. But literally, interestingly enough, notice the Fed funds rate and the prime rate. They really do track each other. Because essentially the Fed funds rate is the rate at which banks lend to each other. And then the prime rate is the rate at which banks lend to their best outside customers. So you would expect those rates to track each other very nicely, perfectly, and they do. You know, it's interesting here. When I look at that, the Fed, like I said, sometimes the Fed funds rate will start to pull off the discount rate. Now here you can see that the prime rate is just sort of like an obedient robot. It is nothing but the Fed funds rate plus. Let me ask you this, if you can read the chart. St. Louis, you, St. Louis there. Can you tell me the prime rate is Fed funds rate plus? Can you see it there? Take a stab at it. Oh, it's more than that. It's more than that. I know, it's a little... Here, let me see if I can make that a little bigger here. I used to know how to, I swear, every time I do this, I thought there was like an expanded button on this. Oh. There. Can you see it better now? Let's do it in real terms, in how we talk. Can you call it? Fed funds rate plus 300. Okay, Fed funds rate plus 300. You see about 300 spread, 300 basis points spread on it. You got your Fed funds rate, and then you got your prime rate there pushing it up. About 300 basis points. You see that? Okay. And notice how it just is obedient as hell. Interestingly enough, though, once in a while you can see something a little odd happening. Notice how you had this drop right in here. And this leveling here. And then you had this major drop. But the prime rate didn't drop as fast or as quite as steeply. Little bit of a difference here based upon how banks were trying to solidify their profit margins because they had been gotten the hell beat out of them. And essentially, banks were in kind of a panic position with respect to their required reserves. There was a day... there was a fellow who spoke to my finance students who told about it. It was when the financial crisis happened. Shortly, a couple of days after September the 15th, 2008, federal regulators got on the phone in conference calls with credit unions all over the United States, their CEOs and their CFOs. And he said to all of them, the regulator who was on the Washington, D.C. end, he said, "For every one of you, you have just overnight lost $2.8 million. It's gone forever." Which means that essentially most of you are now in conservancy. In other words, you are no longer allowed to be credit unions because you've gone below your minimums. Just overnight gone. He said, and you're never going to get it back. It's gone forever. $2.8 million. That was the money that they were all required to put into this one place that just went to hell like that. And, of course, that got an awful lot of quiet stuff happening around the audio conferences, finding out that overnight you had just gotten wiped out. So ever since then, you have seen banks and credit unions trying to solidify their profit margins by keeping a slightly higher bump than they used to over the prime rate for their normal customers. It's just one of the things. You also see banks and credit unions with new profit centers. They beat the hell out of you on fees for overdrafts. They beat the hell out of you on everything that you can imagine. My credit union on Fridays has free donuts. I go in there and I eat the hell out of those donuts because that's the only thing I'm ever going to see free from that credit union ever again because they're all trying to see this big pad they're trying to do. They're all trying to make some money. There you go. But anyway, okay, now, let me take you over here. This is your old friend, the yield curve. The yield curve plots the yield of government treasury instruments against how long it takes them to mature. Nothing big about that. And as I told you, the yield curve can give you some hints and whispers about the future of the economy. In this case, the yield curve today, for the last week or so, well, okay, one thing that it is not a terrifying yield curve. It is not a scary yield curve. Do you remember what makes my back leg twitch when I see a yield curve? What is it that scares me if I see it in a yield curve? Do you remember that one? Anyone remember what it was? What do you call that? An inverted yield curve. If it dips and if it's going up, dips and comes back, even a technical, a tiny, just a few basis points. If a rate out here at 10 years is even a few basis points below the rate at 7 years, something like that. That's a technical inversion. That's when I get really concerned, because that tells me that there may be a recession. Every recession has been preceded by an inverted yield curve. However, not every inverted yield curve has been followed by a recession. In other words, sometimes it'll give you a false signal. But even if there's not a recession, there's going to be a slowdown almost definitely. This does not have any inversion. So I am pretty happy right now on that. However, this yield curve does concern me somewhat. I'm going to draw. I'm going to flip over here just for a second and show you a very healthy yield curve. That's a healthy yield curve. It's a classic. I see this yield curve, it makes my heart warm and my pants damp. If I see this yield curve, my heart's still a little warm, but my pants are very dry. Do you see the difference? What is it that bothers me about this yield curve? I showed you a classic, really great yield curve. The sky is the limit. Julie Andrews is singing "The Hills Are Alive with the Sound of Music." That one singer, the lady who her name starts with a B, B, B. Beyonce. Anyway, she's doing a twerkathon. Everyone's happy. This isn't making me too happy. What do you see? Talk to me. What do you see?
It's a little more straight.
Bingo. Yeah, it is. It's almost like it's on a trajectory that's not smoothing out. That's not easing up. The only thing that can be driving a yield curve in this like this would be the maturity premium or a forward rate on expected inflation that is acting up. In this case, because this is not smoothing out, the maturity premium is indicating that there is an expectation of continuing, possibly even accelerating, interest rate volatility out in the future. It's saying that there is an expectation that inflation out there is not going to be as pleasant as it is back here. Right now, we have something in economics that really bothers people. We have actually deflation in a lot of commodities. That's nasty business. We really don't like deflation. They're even scarier than inflations. The only inflation we saw was in stock prices, and that inflation just went as soon as the Fed started turning the spigots off the money supply. So it's either there is going to be a spreading inflation out there that's not here, or there's going to be more interest rate volatility making the maturity premium get nasty out in the future, unlike where it is right now. One way or the other, though, this is not a particularly healthy yield curve. Now, what I'm doing here is I'm teaching you the soft analytics, as we used to call them. What you do, what you don't learn in an accounting course, what you don't learn in an MQM course, what you do learn when you need to actually have intelligence about your analysis. Now let me show you something interesting here. I'm going to whip this thing out here. Notice how the back end of the yield curve out here quite a few months ago, it was arching upward more. It had more of an upward arching. That's actually a healthier yield curve to a certain extent. That's more like that classic I showed you. But then, it's really, seriously? Is there some reason this sucks? Okay, there. See how it began to flatten out in the intermediates? And it wasn't as pleasant acting. But here's what really got me a little concerned. Look what happened here a couple of weeks ago. Do you see that that yield curve was beginning to whisper, I'm going to invert? That was a little bit weird. See, because it went from being darned healthy, but then it dipped under, and I saw right here. Do you see that? How it was trying to notch there? It didn't. No technical inversion. But boy, it had sort of like this feeling that it needed to have a fart. And fortunately, it pinched its ass in, and it came back up. Up. No, I guess it won't be a recession, just inflation. So you have to watch it. Don't get too excited. I didn't write anything about there being the possibility of a recession because it wasn't inverted, but it was just giving this little feeling. I see how it was had that almost like it was trying to kink there, but then it shook that out and said, nope, just inflation. This is soft analytics, like I said, and it's not the textbook formula. I can't give you a formula. I just have to have you look at these. Now, on the first exam, I might even show you a yield curve, and there'll be something very obvious in it, and I'll say, what is going on? What is this yield curve telling us? And it's not going to be something really subtle and nuanced, but if you don't tell me what I want you to say, you will lose all the points. So make sure that you begin to think about this. I really like stockcharts.com because of this dynamic yield curve they do. It's actually very interesting to be able to watch the dynamics of the market and how the sentiment is changing. Interestingly, what I have a feeling was going on here. See that? It's when the Fed said, we're going to stop shoveling money into the economy. We're going to start contractionary monetary policy. We're going to deliquidify, as they used to say, the economy. I have a feeling the markets had a little bit of a sense that that could be cause a recession. There was enough weakness in the economy. There was a sense that there's a weakness in the economy. The Fed was moving too soon. That might cause a recession. Once that was clear that it was not going to really damage the markets other than to knock the stock market to hell, then the prevailing sentiment moved away from recession possibility. That's how you would see that. Taking all of that aside, let me take you over to one last thing that I need you to do. I need you to humor me here. Well, no, I'm going to have to do it this way. Okay. I'm going to take you to the financial calculator. Okay, I don't want you to see that. Let me get that off there for just a minute. This is section 3. Okay. I'm going to pull up the Pearson Financial Calculator. I'm going to show you a few things, okay? Quick little dirty stuff. The financial calculator. There you go. Once you've got your interest rate, then the sky is the limit. Remember that these interest rates that we are talking about now are not just theoretical animals. They determine the life and death of companies. and the life and death of projects, the life and death of your job prospects. Many of you are going to go over there to that internship fair. Many of you are going to go over to the job career fair that's being held shortly hereafter. Interest rates drive decisions. I'll bet you didn't ever think of this, but you, madam, are a project. If I am an employer, I am hiring you. That means that I am renting an asset. You are the asset. And I'm going to rent you. My assumption will be that I'm renting you for a long period of time. I'm going to invest a considerable amount of money in you, and with the expectation that you will produce money for me afterwards. Took my students to St. Louis to, it's an insurance company, but down there they do financial analysis, credit risk analysis. And they were pitching their program for my students to go there. Of course, almost every one of my students, I don't want it. I want Chicago. I don't want to say, oh, shut up. This is a great job. Chicago sucks compared to this job. You're going to work at a deli in Chicago. No, anyway, that's not true. But, you know, I didn't get a lot of interest, even though the jobs were very cool. You'd actually, during your training period, you'd be taken out all over the place. You'd walk on a 10-story building that was under construction. You would walk on a barge. You would go to places to start learning how to assess and price risk. But they said, general manager down at the St. Louis branch, when he was talking to the students, my students, he said, we are going to be negative on you for 18 to 24 months. Realistically, we are going to plow a couple $100,000 into you and get nothing out of it. Then over the next couple of years, you will slowly begin to earn your keep. By about year 5, we figure you will be a positive net present value project to us. So it was kind of sobering to realize you are an investment. So I would analyze you like I would anything else. And in order to find out what the present value of your future expected cash flows is, so I could compare that to the cost of you, I need your discount rate. Madam, what is your discount rate?
I have no idea.
You have no idea what it is. I mean, you obviously you've never thought of it. You don't sometimes... You take do one of those selfies and put up on Instagram, "Hi guys, what's my discount rate?" God, kids these days. But you see, you have a discount rate. Hey, take a step. What's yours?
5%.
Oh, hell no. It's higher than that. But that's okay. At least you gave me one. It would probably be a very high interest rate, discount rate. Because you are an unknown quantity, that creates risk. We don't know if there will be a job fit. We're going to hire you trying to figure out some preliminaries, but at the end of the day, it's still going to be risky. Also, if you are too good, you know what happens down there at that company? He said their worst problem? They spend the 18 months training these new finance and accounting grads whom they've hired. And then one of the other companies that does the same stuff hires them out at a higher salary. Essentially, you've spent 18 grueling months. You've walked across catwalks 20 stories up with wind blowing you around. You've gone on barges. You've walked around with pigs that squealed at you, and a couple of the sows actually kind of liked you, and you kind of had to run. Okay, so after 18 months of this, well, you really know your business. You're making $80,000 a year there, and then some other company that does the same thing in St. Louis or Chicago says, "We'll pay $120,000. Do you have loyalty?" Oh, hell no. You're just going to walk. I mean, you greedy son of a bitch. You're going to just walk. Do you see how risky you are to a new employer? They know you don't have any loyalty. They're going to try to keep you loyal by compensating you well and all that and finding out dirt about your past. I don't know. But the thing of it is that there's going to be a discount rate on you. What would it be? I don't know. I've seen some speculation, interestingly enough, that right now, currently, even though interest rates are fairly low, they've gone up some out now that the Fed's squeezing the money supply. But right now, maybe you have a discount rate, quite honestly, about 16%. High risk, high expected return. So you got to meet a hurdle rate when you go out there. That's why they bitch at us and we bitch at you. You know, wear your nice clothes, act like a robot, never question authority, eat your vegetables every morning. Essentially, they figure that they can lower the risk if we make you a smooth, uniform goo, which I don't like, and I try to make you think that you don't always have to be that way. But let's try something here. I'm going to show you, first of all, I want to make sure you understand something I told you earlier in the course that probably didn't have a lot of meaning. It probably doesn't have a whole lot of meaning yet. Corporate and government debt differs fundamentally from private debt. With private debt, when you take out a loan, your interest payments, your monthly payments amortize a little bit of the principal every payment and service the debt, pay interest for the month or whatever. With corporate and government debt, that's not the case. All that is paid by a company that borrows money from investors, all that is paid through the life of the instrument is interest. And then at the end, one last interest payment is made, and then the face value of the debt, what you borrowed, is paid back all at once. Now, face value, unless I say otherwise, I'm repeating myself here, unless I say otherwise, all corporate and government debt is $1,000 or an increment of that. So face value, FV, is always $1,000 for corporate debt. The coupon on corporate or government debt is the interest that is paid. And it's expressed as a percent of the face value. So if I said an 8% IBM 2046, that would be a new issue bond by IBM. It would go for 30 years. So there would be 30 payments of interest. Actually, there would be 60. They pay it semi-annually. We'll deal with that later. But there would be technically 30 payments. Each one of them, 8% of $1,000. 8% of $1,000. So in other words, $80. So every year, if you lend IBM $1,000, every year for 30 years, you will get an $80 check. In 2046, you would get one last $80 check, and you would get a check for $1,000, what you lent IBM. That's how government and corporate debt works. Fundamentally different from private, because in private debt, you're paying off some of the balance every month with your payment. As the loan gets farther along, more of what your payment's going to the principal than to the interest. Early on, most of your payments are going to the interest and only a little is going to the principal. But with corporate and government debt, it's different. So here's the upshot. Here's the upshot. I'm going to give you a quick, dirty... Now, the problem is... The problem is that when I calculate payments on a private loan, it's just a pure, ordinary level annuity. The payments are a constant, and I can use a very simple formula to get to the answer. With corporate and government debt, though, there's something else. It's not a perfectly level annuity. Because it's level with the payments all along the way until the last one, which blows the whole level annuity thing, because the last one is an interest payment plus $1,000. So let me show you. 10F 2036 7% bond. That says that this bond has 20 years and will be 20. The coupon payments will be $70 each. There's going to be one more thing we need. It's going to be what the market thinks TNF should pay. Now, this company will probably try to give the market what it wants, but it can miss. As a matter of fact, it will be off as time goes on because the 7% is going to be fixed and interest rates are going to go up and down. Let's say that the market discounts these coupon payments at 7.2%. In other words, now I'm going to have to ask you to do this. You're dressed too damn well to be left alone. You lend me money. I say, all right, I'm going to pay you 7.0%. You wanted 7.2%. Now, are you going to be happy or are you going to be pissed? I'm going to pay you 7%. The market wanted 7.2%. Are you going to be happy or are you going to be Mr. Sad Face?
Sad.
You're going to be sad. Now, you know what sad means in finance?
No.
Someone's going to get a paddling. Uh-huh. Watch how we do this. Now, remember, the company's going to borrow $1,000. Watch. So, this is a 20-year bond. N is going to be 20. The interest rate, this is what the market wants. This isn't the 7%. This is the market's want. See that? It's a yield. We call it a yield. The yield to maturity, in fact. That yield to maturity is 7.2% with one payment per year. Now, the payments that I'm going to give are the $70, 7%, $70. And we're going to keep doing these until you get like old hand at this. Payment is $70. And there's one other thing that I need to put in before I can see the price of this bond. The future value, the face value. Do you remember what I said face value of a bond is always, unless I say differently? 1,000. You will always put a 1,000 in face value. Future value. 1,000. Now let's see what the price of the bond will be. In other words, what I will actually lend. Compute the price value. Well, spank me. I'm promising to pay back $1,000 and you're going to lend me only $979.14. That's your paddling. This bond sells at a discount to par. Write that down. This bond sells at a discount to par. Because it is not paying what the market wants it to pay. The market wants it to pay 7.2%, but this company is going to pay only 7%, $70 a year. Now let's switch the story. Going back here to the document camera, let's say that the market, I was wrong, 7.2% is way too much to expect. This is really a safe company. This company really should pay only 6.7%. Oh, but this company is actually paying 7%, but I really wanted only 6.7%. So if I'm getting 7% and I wanted 6.7%, is that going to make me sad or happy? Very happy. That's where I get that heart warm and the pants damp thing. Yeah. So let's go back and fix that bond and see what happens. Let's go back in there and replace that 7.2% with 6.7% on the I over Y. And now let's recompute the price of the bond. $1,032.54. This bond sells at a premium to par. Par is 1,000. This bond is being generous with its coupon payments. It sells at a premium to par. The bond that was not generous, it was giving less than the market wanted, it sold at a discount to par. Last piece of terminology. This is the price of the bond, but if you go to a financial paper or a financial website, you will not see this. What you will see is 103.25. 103.25. The quote is a tenth of the price. And that's almost always how they are reported, is as a quote. I had a friend of mine, he thought he was some financial guru some years back in the early days of PCs. He had all this financial software that was kind of crappy, of MS-DOS and all that. And he thought he was a genius investor. And he said, I'm going to go for bonds. I'm going to buy a bond. So he bought a bond. And he saw the quote, 90, it was 95.12. He got his bill from the broker for nine. He ordered 10 of them. And he got a bill for like $95,000. He almost had a fit. What the hell? It was a $95 bond. No, Frank, that was actually the quote. The actual price was $950 or so. You bought 10, it was like $9,000. You bought 10 $950 bonds, not 10 $95. Why did they say that? Well, they haven't said it for like three centuries. Quotes like this, the reason they started this way, and it's just a historical fossil. They used to print them on these broadsheets back in the 1700s, 1800s. So they needed to have these columns that they could fit the numbers in. So they essentially, it just sort of came about that they did things to a tenth of the actual prices instead of to the actual prices, just to save a little bit of column width on the broadsheets. But it's still to this day. Watch it. When you see a bond, you're probably seeing a quote on that bond, not what you will pay when you buy that bond. Just be sure of that. That's all I have for you. Thank you.